This podcast of The Exchange is sponsored by
Doucette Survey, serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England, now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine. Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. Enjoy the show.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. On Capitol Hill, the turmoil over trade continues. For weeks, the U.S. House and Senate have been debating trade legislation defined by a confusing set of acronyms, the TPA, the TAA, and their central focus, the TPP, which stands for Trans-Pacific Partnership, a 12-nation trade deal. In the U.S. Senate, Democrat Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts has been a leading opponent.
Who will benefit from the TPP? American workers, consumers, small businesses, taxpayers, or the biggest multinational corporations in the world?
On the other side, allied in favor are President Obama and Republican lawmakers. Here's the president pushing back against members of his own party in an interview on MSNBC.
I would not be doing this trade deal if I did not think it was good for the middle class. And when you hear folks make a lot of suggestions about how bad this trade deal is, when you dig into the facts, they are wrong.
Meanwhile, here in New Hampshire and New England, the Pacific trade deal could have a big impact. Of course, whether that's positive or a negative depends upon who you ask. Today in The Exchange, what's in this deal for the Granite State? And just as important, what isn't in it? Let's hear from you. Your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from D.C. is Christopher Rowland. He's a reporter and Washington bureau chief for the Boston Globe. And Chris, great to have you. Thank you for making time.
Glad to be here.
Also with us in studio, Mark McKenzie, president of the New Hampshire AFL-CIO, the state's largest labor union. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And also with us, Don Wivel, CEO of Firebrand International and former longtime director of New Hampshire's International Trade Resource Center. And Donna, welcome back to you, too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I want to start with you, Chris, please. Let's just get through some of these acronyms that I presented a minute ago, the TAA, the TPA, and the TPP. Can you just help us out with this, Chris? What do all these mean? And can you say if one is more important than the others?
Sure. So I tend to, you know, when I think about it, I don't think in terms of the acronyms, but they make easy shorthand for sure. And that's where you hear a lot of the jargon being spoken in Washington. The major goal here is, as the president said in his remark that you just played, is to create this massive trans-Pacific trade deal. And that is the ultimate goal. But what we have right now in Congress is an interim goal called Fast Track, or TPA. And what this would do is trade promotion authority is TPA. And it would give the president the authority to finish negotiating the Trans-Pacific deal and bring it back to Congress later for an up or down vote with no chance for amendments. So it's a complex process, and it's a big sweeping trade deal. And then TAA is a sort of a tacked-on provision that provides economic assistance for displaced workers who are displaced by international trade, and that's something that's very popular with Democrats. So the reason it's getting really complicated now is because of all the parliamentary maneuvering as the president tries to get Republicans and some Democrats to vote for the Trade Promotion Authority. And they're using as leverage the TAA, which a lot of Democrats support, but a lot of Republicans oppose. So there's sort of a game of three-dimensional chess going on right now in the Capitol, and it gets definitely confusing. But the essential part is that it's a big deal that the public has not been able to read. So it has a lot of really intricate provisions about trade with foreign economies throughout the Pacific region. There's a lot of Democrats who don't like that about the lack of transparency, and that's really where you're seeing that resistance from the Democrats. And also unions flexing their muscle having a great deal of success convincing Democrats to buck the president.
So when you say it and that there hasn't been enough transparency surrounding it, you mean the Trans-Pacific Partnership, Chris?
So there's a draft. This draft has been in the works for years, and it's been in negotiation behind closed doors by the administration and by the Department of State, the U.S. Trade Representative, and various industry groups. So the draft is actually, hammered out. But the public hasn't had a chance to look at that and view it. Members of Congress can view it. They go into a secret room in the Capitol where they're not allowed to take notes and they can read it, but they can come out and they're not allowed to say anything about what's in it because, these are very sensitive negotiations. And in any kind of negotiation, negotiators will tell you they can't negotiate in public. So the process itself is thorny and politically difficult for the president.
It does kind of make you wonder at this juncture, Chris. There's so much going on in the country and internationally with security and Iraq and ISIS and so forth. Why is President Obama pushing so hard for this right now?
Well, this is to be seen in the context of a couple things. One is the president's legacy. I think he's looking for a major economic feather in his cap to round out his presidency, and this would certainly be it. It's a major deal affecting trillions of dollars of global economics, of global trade. And it's also about competition with China, about influence in the Pacific Rim, economic influence. China is growing exponentially and exerting its economic power throughout the Far East in much greater dimension. And the U.S. U.S. corporations, businesses, Chamber of Commerce, and the government, the U.S. Trade Representative, they don't want to get left behind here, and they want to get access to these markets. There's a really big motivating factor in terms of the trade and the trade imbalances that are seen by the U.S. business community.
So it sounds like it's economic and strategic. We want to sort of be a counterweight to China there.
Absolutely, yeah.
No, go ahead, Chris.
Well, then on the other side, though, you have an enormous amount of opposition coming from unions who have seen these trade deals in the past, and they are very concerned that it will not create the promised middle-class jobs that the president and the business community say will materialize. And so that's where the real conflict is coming in. And those are the essential dynamics that are driving the rest of the debate.
All right. Well, and I want to bring our guests into the studio, into this conversation as well. And since he mentioned labor, Mark McKenzie, why doesn't the AFL-CIO like this deal?
For a long time, the AFL-CIO has opposed trade policies, which we believe have undermined and cost workers in this country, jobs, millions of jobs, quite frankly. We are in a position, being put in a position once again, where a world economy who does not play by the rules in many of these places that Chris mentioned, and by the way, I think he did a terrific job, It really undermines the workers' wages, working conditions, environmental conditions. In many of those countries, you can never meet those thresholds. And so what happens is there are incentives for American corporations to move overseas, to capture what they can, to get an advantage over American workers who have built an economy based around you know, rules, regulations, but more importantly, around good wages and good benefits. So that's what we stand for, and we think that this undermines that.
So those trends are already happening, been happening for a long time. We hear about companies, you know, quote-unquote, shipping jobs overseas. So how would this trade deal, in your opinion, Mark, accelerate those trends?
Well,
it's going on already.
Sure. Well, it has. And so if you give a look back to some of the trade policies that we've seen in the past, you know, going back to NAFTA and other things, it's been a it certainly hasn't been a win-win for American workers. We've lost, again, millions of jobs. We've seen factories close left and right. I mean, you look around the state of New Hampshire, and while they are older industries, you know, shoes, paper, textiles, other things like that, you've also seen other corporations in New Hampshire bend under the pressure of other parts of the country, of parts of the world, who pay their workers nothing to make products. And I think what the real problem is that they can then in turn flood the United States with products made by workers who are paid nothing and undermine any opportunity we have to grow our economy and manufacturing sector and other things.
Okay, and a lot more to follow up with you there, Mark. But I do want to get Don into this. Okay, Don, so we have heard this longtime concern about trade agreements. Why do you think that this Trans-Pacific Partnership is important to New Hampshire?
Well, I think trade agreements are critical to helping companies in the U.S. Expand into foreign markets. My opinion is that, and my experience is that exports create jobs. If you want to talk about NAFTA, for instance, as soon as NAFTA passed, New Hampshire started exporting huge amounts of products to Mexico, became one of our largest markets. Actually, it was our number one market almost immediately after NAFTA was passed. I've seen it create a lot of jobs locally. If you want to talk about traditional industries, our oldest textile company is a huge exporter. So I think all trade agreements provide access, standardization. It gives us leverage in terms of creating better labor standards around the world, as well as environmental standards and so forth. So I see it as a job creator, not a job loser.
We've heard a lot about lower wages once these trade deals pass. So even if you don't lose jobs, wages are depressed by that competitive factor from other countries where you don't have to pay people as much as you pay here. I wonder how you work through that, Don.
Well, that competition exists with or without trade agreements. So the lower wage countries still exist, whether or not we have a trade agreement with said country. That doesn't change. So if a company wants to manufacture overseas, that isn't established by a trade agreement. That labor market still exists.
Does the trade deal make it easier, though, to put those jobs over there?
I don't see how it does. Countries offer a lot of incentives for companies to set up operations, and those are regardless of trade deals.
Lots more to talk about after a break, including, Chris, to you, how much the ghost of NAFTA is haunting this current debate. We'll talk about that in just a minute. The exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the big trade debates going on Capitol Hill, 1-800-892-6477. We're looking at a deal called the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the difficulty that the president has had in getting Congress to agree with this. We're finding out how this deal might affect New Hampshire, all the politics around it. 1-800-892-6477. If you're a business owner, what do you think of this trade legislation? Do you see it as beneficial? Do you have concerns about it? If you're a worker or an employee at a New Hampshire business, what do you think about this trade debate? Do you think that these agreements will be good for companies here and for employees? Or do you think they might adversely affect your job? Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. So to you, Chris Rowland in D.C., how much is the ghost of NAFTA haunting this debate right now?
Oh, very much so, I think. NAFTA is a major part of the debate. A lot of the Democratic representatives and senators from northeastern states throughout the upper Midwest, you know, are opposing this deal. And a lot of it has to do with the memories of NAFTA and other trade deals that were promised to bring better manufacturing jobs to their states and their districts. And in many cases, they didn't. As we all know, manufacturing has continued to be decimated throughout New England and the upper Midwest over the last several decades. And, you know, it's a very complicated factor. These things play out over long, many, many years. So it's hard to say, well, NAFTA did this, NAFTA did that. But the fact is that, you know, these economies are still struggling, especially post-2008 recession. So it's really instructive to find out, like, who go look and see who's for this and who's against it. In Massachusetts, it's interesting because when most of the new modern technologies, biotech, tech, inside the belt, inside Route 128, I should say, many of those industries are totally in favor of this. But when you get outside that, you know, sort of modern economic hub, and you get to places like Fall River, New Bedford, Springfield, you know, and then into New Hampshire for sure, Nashua, Manchester, you're finding pockets of resistance to the big trade deal based on memories of NAFTA, other trade deals, where they have not seen the fruits, the promised fruits, the new jobs. And so you have business leadership, small businesses opposed, and you have political leadership, local mayors and council members and lawmakers against. So, you know, that's, it kind of breaks down on, and the debate breaks down over, you know, who has fond memories of NAFTA and who doesn't. Another one is the Korea deal, which was more recent. There was a U.S.-Korea trade agreement that was promised to bring, you know, many more jobs and close the trade deficit, between South Korea and the United States. And so far in the last first several years of this deal, the trade deficit has doubled. So and mostly on the backs of Korean car imports. So, you know, a lot of the evidence can be pointed to as actually hurting manufacturing jobs. But the thing is that these things play out over so long a period that it's difficult to say with certainty that NAFTA killed jobs.
Yeah, that's the tricky thing, isn't it, all of you? You know, it's there's so many other economic forces that is it reasonable, Mark McKenzie, to just point to NAFTA and say that's the problem with the decline of manufacturing in this country?
Well, I think that there's a lot of issues that that are problematic for our economy as it relates to trade. But certainly these trade agreements that, quite frankly, are negotiated in back rooms and secret rooms and basement of the state of the U.S. Capitol, this lack of transparency, this lack of opportunity to be able to get information about exactly what's going on causes us to be more suspicious. So I think we start from the frame of NAFTA. We go through other trade agreements, and we end up in a place where, you know, we really don't trust anybody. And one of the things I think labor is saying is get this out, make sure people understand what the deal is. And, you know, I think that Don mentioned, you know, the idea that a lot of standards in other countries are subpar, for instance. This gives us an opportunity, I think, to be able to use the leverage of this trade agreement, use that leverage and be able to increase the standards of other countries or demand that they be increased and level the playing field between the United States and some of these other countries, which is clearly not what's going on now.
When you say level the playing field, what do you mean?
We should, if you have environmental standards or you have wage standards or your safety and health standards or you have other things that are in the United States that are things that we value and have worked on for a number of years, why should we allow countries who basically cut all of those things out and then be able to come to the United States and flood the United States with their own products? I think that's bad policy, and it's we should use the power that we have in this negotiations to advance the opportunities for all people, to level that playing field, to make sure that other people comply. Because when that imbalance exists in our economy, then it also it's an incentive to go to other countries and run away from what is and should be, you know, valuable standards.
How far do you take it, though, Mark? I mean, some of these countries are very poor. You can't ask them to pay their workers $20 an hour. right? I mean, if the, you know, if the whole standard of living is lower.
You could certainly start right off the bat by making sure that people, first of all, have the opportunity to advocate for themselves.
That they can unionize.
That they can unionize, that they can form work groups, that they can do other things to improve their own lives. But they have to do that in the context of an agreement that embraces the idea that that we should have better standards for people around the world.
Well, to the secretiveness, because that is a criticism that keeps coming up. And here's an email from Arnie who says, representatives of multinational corporations that export goods and services to other countries have preferential access to our trade negotiators. Arnie says, is that why the result is skewed to their interests rather than the interests of consumers, environmental protection, domestic production, and democratic governance? That does seem to be a problem for folks, Don Wivel, that it's kind of secret and we don't really know what's in there. So how can we judge it?
Well, I think that's why we want to get Trade Promotion Authority passed, the new version of Trade Promotion Authority. That's, you know, really where my focus is right now.
That's the Fast Track Authority.
Fast Track Authority, which actually has been updated since 2002. Last time it was in place was 2007. But it's been updated to include a public comment period. There's a 60-day period. Once, let's say, a trade agreement like TPP is finalized, there's a 60-day period for the public to take a look at it and make comments and excuse me, before the president can sign it. In addition, members of Congress can take a look at the agreement as it's being negotiated. They can even attend negotiations.
Which that's different. You're
that's
saying
very
from
different.
Before.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there are inclusions of things that have to do with labor standards, as Mark was talking about, environmental standards, which is a big issue with a lot of people, and also for the first time ever, human rights standards. And so I believe that, not to go off track much, but I do believe that we can use our leverage as a powerhouse economy, the largest economy in the world, to upgrade human rights issues, environmental standards, and labor standards around the world.
So it's almost like you and Mark are in agreement there, Don.
Yeah, I admit that I think the disagreement is that we can use these trade agreements to leverage that. Because if without them, how are we a player? How can we affect standards around the world
if we're not engaged
exactly.
in these countries? You know, I did want to ask you a very quick question, Chris Rowland, and then go to our listeners about this fast track authority that Don mentioned. This is the TPA part of this whole discussion. It's my understanding, Chris, that almost every modern president has had this ability to negotiate trade agreements according to this fast track authority, an up or down vote. You know, he doesn't have to go through all the minutia. Why doesn't President Obama have this fast track authority?
I think that in the past, Congresses have given it more freely. And what we're seeing now is that in particular, I mean, Elizabeth Warren has been extremely effective in carrying a public message that has shined a huge light on this and has mobilized a lot of opposition. I mean, you have the Democratic Party is fractured now. It's not fractured nearly to the extent that the Republican Party is, but there's definitely, you see in the last several years, a growing split between the liberal side and the centrist side of the Democratic Party. And so that is playing out, I think, quite strongly here. The president is a lame duck president, and Elizabeth Warren has been extremely effective in focusing her power of the bully pulpit, a freshman senator, sort of extraordinary, actually, to focus in on the secrecy aspects and persuade other Democrats to go along with her argument and the argument of labor and other Democrats that that Congress would be ceding its ability to pass laws by basically signing away its ability to amend the agreement once it's done being negotiated. And so that's what you've heard over and over. This they've pounded the whole issue of transparency, and people have less trust in government now than they used to. So transparency arguments do carry weight. Additionally, Elizabeth Warren has also been very effective in arguing that it could result in the rollback of financial regulations through the use of international tribunals, which is a very highly debatable point, but she has driven it quite hard, and also setting up giving fast-track authority to future presidents. So this fast-track TPA would allow for the next big trade deal coming down the pike, the transatlantic deal, to also get fast-track. So, you know, giving future presidents a great deal of free hand, and, you know, Democrats know that that could very well be a Republican. So there's a lot of powerful arguments against, on the Democratic side, against giving their own president this authority.
All right, let's go to our listeners. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Arnie, thank you for that email. You can email us at exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Jim's in Hampton. Hi, Jim, you're on the Exchange. Go ahead.
Hi. I live in Canton. In my wife's family had a textile mill. It was one of the last operating woolen mills in the country. Five generations, the family owned it, and the entire town of Ashland was built around it. It's L.W. Packard. And, you know, it was a corporation, a really family-oriented corporation that, you know, they supported the schools. Every church in town got a donation every year. The ball fields, I mean, it's what a corporate America used to represent. You know, the people made a good living here. That went from about 300 employees working two and three shifts year-round, debt-free company. It went to out of business in 2 years after NAFTA was passed. But the woman that was speaking earlier, I can't remember her name, who said that NAFTA actually bought jobs in New Hampshire. I argue there's no way that what it did bring, if it bought anything, would outweigh the loss of jobs like L.W. Packard going out of business. These companies, one of the family members told me they couldn't even weave wool. They could actually import a finished shirt from China cheaper than they could even just make the fabric to make that shirt.
So
how does that make America competitive? It's insane.
The decline in manufacturing, and Jim's right, you know, these mills played such a huge role in making their own communities vibrant, and you still see the buildings today, some of them revitalized, like in Manchester, and some of them kind of sitting there. Don, I think that's directed at you. Real concern that NAFTA was not good for New Hampshire.
Well, textile industry in particular, and I weave myself, so I hate to hear this, but textile industry is the first industry to suffer in any country, you know, as the economy changes and trade increases. But like I said, our oldest textile mill in New Hampshire, a family-owned Warwick Mills out in New Ipswich, they're still in their old mill. They actually are still in business. They do a lot of international trade. They've moved into more advanced materials. They started, I think, making woolen blankets for buggy rides, and now they're making materials for bulletproof vests for the Dutch police force, for instance. So it's a matter of progressing with the economy. And unfortunately for some of these traditional businesses, we are more of a knowledge economy type country, a type of economy. So some of these industries will suffer.
What kinds of New Hampshire businesses are backing this bill?
I would say any kind of business. I have companies that I work with that are bakers all the way to aerospace manufacturers. For instance, aerospace and aviation, aeronautics is one of our fastest growing industries, and the Trans-Pacific area, or the TPP area, is one of the areas of focus for companies. So if you can help them to get into those markets through a trade agreement, then they would absolutely be behind
the TPP,
yeah.
The 20-nation deal. All right. Well, thank you for that call, Jim. And again, the number, 1-800-892-6477. Don's in Manchester. Hi, Don. Go ahead. You're in the Exchange.
Yes. Yes. Good morning, Laura.
Morning.
I just wanted to say I worked for a billionaire at one point from Thailand. He went to school with my brother. And I took care of his two kids when they went to school here. And then he had two daughters that were educated in London. The two girls, one of the girls, when they graduated, he bought her a BMW X3, which cost, whatever, $45,000 here. Do you know what he paid for that in Thailand?
No.
$128,000. 300% tariff.
So
and that's where these trade agreements get really skewed. I mean, I know Thailand's not part of this, you know, part of this trade agreement, but I've been to many countries in Southeast Asia for the last 20 years, mm-hmm. and I've seen this stuff. I've seen sneakers being made, shipped over here, total cost $16, $17, and then they sell them here for $179.
So if
it's ridiculous.
Are you in favor of the trade deal then, Don, because it would lower tariffs like that?
No. And I'm not an isolationist either, but in the same token, too, you know, there's probably about, I don't know, $6, $7 trillion that these big corporations, multinational corporations, are keeping overseas that they don't want to bring back here because they don't want to pay their fair share like everybody else does.
Okay.
And rebuild this country.
All right. So another vote against the trade deal if the exchange audience was voting. What do you think, Christopher Rowland, the idea that, you know, tariffs are problematic and people are just suspicious that this is going to work out in their favor?
Well, it's really interesting because it's kind of fun to look when you start looking at individual cases, individual retail markets and the way tariffs work. I think Nike is a really good example because Nike right now manufactures all of their sneakers overseas, and they are so eager to get rid of the tariffs that are barriers to their to selling more sneakers throughout the Pacific Rim that they're saying if you can pass this TPP and get rid of these tariffs and throughout East Asia, that they will then guarantee that they can make, you know, 10,000 to 20,000 new jobs making sneakers here domestically.
That's right. President Obama went to Nike.
It's going to be so robust, and this is the pledge they made when the president went and visited there about a month ago, that their exports of sneakers, that their business and sales of sneakers would be so robust that they could add thousands of new jobs domestically. On the flip side of that, you have New Balance, which makes sneakers in Maine and Massachusetts, as well as overseas. But a lot of their manufacturing is still right here. Our neighbors, New Hampshire's neighbors, are working in these factories. They want to keep the tariffs in place.
Okay. Chris, I got to cut you off there, but we'll pick it up after a short break. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoi. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at the trade agreement that's being debated on Capitol Hill, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, also fast-track authority related to the president's authority to negotiate these trade deals. We're sorting it all out and what it might mean for the Granite State. You can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. If you're a business, what do you think of this trade legislation? Do you think you would benefit from it? Do you have concerns about it? If you're an employee, do you think that these agreements are good for New Hampshire workers or not? Again, 1-800-892-6477. And Chris Rowland, sorry about that. We had to go to a quick break. I did want to let you finish up on this idea that Don, our caller, raised concerns about tariffs and how they would be affected with this. You were telling a really interesting example, Chris, about two shoe manufacturers, sneaker manufacturers right here in New England and how they feel about this trade deal. Go ahead. I want to let you finish that up.
Right. So competitors, you know, see these tariffs in two different ways. So Nike wants the tariffs eliminated so they can expand their markets in Asia, whereas New Balance, which still has some domestic manufacturing and is reaping the economic benefits of that by having a protectionist tariff in place, they don't want the tariffs removed on sneakers. So it's just sort of an interesting idea of like there's winners and losers no matter which way you slice it on many little mini slices of the economy.
Let's take another call. And this is Aaron in Alton Bay. Hi, Aaron. Go ahead. You're on The Exchange. Welcome.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
I
appreciate it. I just wanted to bring up the point and wonder if your guests have anything to comment on regarding how these different trade deals influence immigration. For instance, when you have companies in their race to the bottom to find the cheapest labor force, they come into a company, whether it be Mexico, like a Coca-Cola, set up shop, obviously offer a lot of jobs to the communities that they come in effect in those host countries, and then they find better deals elsewhere, and then they take their company elsewhere, and in the vacuum that's left over, you have a bunch of people that need to try and feed their families, and oftentimes maybe were uprooted from family farms or whatnot, and now you've got an immigration problem for surrounding countries. If Japanese farmers get put out of business, is that going to influence, other countries around their region with immigration trying to find work to feed their families?
Okay, Aaron, thanks for the call. And this does relate, folks, to, again, the influence of sort of NAFTA overshadowing this whole conversation. Chris, to you again, I did remember watching a documentary years back that said that because of NAFTA, Mexican farmers couldn't compete with big American farms. So they shut down their sort of small family-run farms and came over the border looking for opportunity here in this country. Can you comment on trade deals like the one that's at play right now and how they might affect immigration?
Absolutely. I think, it does, change and churn in the economy will create economic dislocation. You will have jobs changing. You will have jobs moving from high labor areas to low labor areas. It's just a natural occurrence, and that's why a lot, artificial trade barriers are so popular in domestic politics, not just here but elsewhere, because you tend to keep that stability in place, and you'll have that those stable kinds of corporate relationships. Like one of that earlier caller was talking about, there was a company town where they the corporation provided the softball fields. But what the modern economists are saying that's all very nice, but what we need to have is a globalized economy where we can deal with this churn and really supercharge our economy and be able to have many more exports, and that these corporations can take advantage of all the different markets that are overseas, and that people will have to be retrained. They may have to move. I mean, there's a whole theory now of economic thought where people who are in states with low manufacturing or low economic opportunities need to get, basically bus tickets and move to other states. If you look at the economic opportunity maps in the South, there's less opportunity than there is, for example, in the North. So economic churn happens, and it definitely happens because of trade deals.
I want to ask you that, Mark McKenzie. It's kind of a philosophical question. How do labor unions deal with economic churn? I like that turn of a phrase that Chris is using.
The labor movement, many of our unions have invested millions of dollars in training programs and partnerships around the country to try to bring the American worker to a place where they can be more competitive. I think one of the cornerstones and one of the things that's holding this whole thing up is the whole trade adjustment assistance piece.
TAA, another acronym.
And that's – so it's a good – a segue to it, that is really the way that new workers get trained. It's an investment in the workforce. It provides people an opportunity to make these kinds of transitions that they need to make. We've been skeptical about that legislation in the past, primarily because you have to have the jobs and the opportunities, and all the training in the world won't help if you don't have them. But certainly to enter into a trade deal that could potentially dislocate workers, trade adjustment assistance becomes really important for people all throughout the United States, and it's something that needs to be – we need to keep that. And what's happening now, and Chris, without getting too far in the weeds, but they are basically separating that out from the Fast Track Authority, which is one of the reasons I think we're going to have some difficulty with this legislation, one of the reasons we opposed it and continue to oppose it.
So just to make it crystal clear, and correct me if I'm wrong, so Mark, TAA, Trade Adjustment Assistance, that's when if I lose my job and I can directly say it's because of, that trade deal, I can get assistance from the federal government to retrain myself for a new career.
That's right.
And how successful has that been?
Well, I mean, in different parts of the country, I mean, the kinds of investment we've been making, I think it has been successful. And that's one of the reasons we advocate for it. I don't think any economy that's in transition from, old-fashioned manufacturing, high-tech manufacturing can anticipate that workers are just going to learn that on their own. I think they're going to need opportunities and help, as is business, to try to make those kinds of adjustments. So that's those are the kinds of things in the bill.
Well, and to you, Chris, just to sort this out, and it's really confusing, but so Mark's right. So Democrats in general like this trade adjustment assistance because they think, okay, at least workers will get some help if they're displaced. But what's happening then on Capitol Hill with this trade adjustment assistance? Because it's been shifting.
Right. Well, it's basically TAA. That piece of the bill was broken off in the House as sort of a bargaining chip. So when the Senate first passed the TPA bill, TAA was lumped in. So they were passed together, and that's how they got 14 Democrats to vote in favor of this and send it over to the House.
So Democrats said, "Okay, we're nervous about this, but at least it has the worker help." Go ahead.
Right. Exactly. So then it gets over to the House, and the political dynamics are much different, and you're not going to be able to get enough Republicans to vote for TAA. They don't like it. They think that, you know, those types of expenditures on worker retraining are sort of, you know, they smack of New Deal politics, and they're not into it. So what they had to do in the House was break the two bills apart to try to get enough Democrats to vote for TAA, and then try to get enough Republicans to vote for TPA that they would be able to pass both. And what happened was the Democrats who were opposing the president's entire initiative here figured out the other thing that the House did was they passed – this makes it complicated – they passed a rule that says these both have to pass for anything to pass, so to anything to get to the president's desk. So – you can't have one without the other. And so the Democrats seized upon that to kill TAA, even though they like it, and sort of a reverse backflip, if you will, parliamentary-wise. And then TPA did pass on its own. So now they had another vote on TPA and sent that back to the Senate. So now what you have is TPA going back to the Senate all by its little lonesome.
Fast track,
and
yeah.
Without the TAA attached. And that's where the state of play is now, because now you're going to have trouble getting those Democrats on board who voted for the full package with TAA attached. It's not in there anymore. And how are you going to get those Democrats on board? And that's where Mitch McConnell is facing a difficult week right now.
Well, Don Wyvil, to you, you know, as someone who works with New Hampshire businesses who export, who wants to help these businesses find those markets and sell to them, how do you feel when you hear Chris just describe all this? It's kind of crazy there on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, it is. Like you said, my job is to help New Hampshire companies or U.S. companies export. And so to see this kind of strange jockeying politically doesn't make any sense to me. TAA, for instance, I always found really annoying when
again,
I...
Again, that's fast track. I keep jumping in just so people know.
TAA.
TAA, that's the worker help, right?
I could go off on TAA. It's not funded well enough. It also had a lot of parameters around it that made it very difficult to use.
Prove, for example, that you were displaced by a particular deal.
Right, and you know, the people who were implementing TAA were not allowed to market it to companies. I mean, there are some very strange things that are sort of enveloped in that whole thing. So, you know, I there are things that are in the sort of down in the weeds that I find very annoying that I could go off on forever. But, you know, I'm very interested in TTIP, for instance, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership. That's a real win-win potential for all of us and has a lot of the things that people don't like about TPP are not in TTIP because of the kinds of countries we would be dealing with. So I think we're really going to lose out if we don't get TPA passed.
TTIP, oh, I don't know if I want to go there. What does that stand for? It's another T acronym. Go ahead.
That's the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership between the U.S. and the European Union, the 28 countries of the EU. Which would be great for New Hampshire companies.
Well, then, one of you mentioned that earlier, and that has to do with giving the president fast-track trade authority to negotiate not just the Pacific deal that's before us right now, but this later Atlantic deal.
I actually think that we would not be having the problems that we're having with TPA if TTIP were sort of more in view, or if that were being sort of negotiated as a priority over TPP. No, I'm getting confused with all the acronyms, but I think the transatlantic one is a lot more to the liking of people than the transpacific.
You know, one analysis that I saw, all of you said, you know, as we talk about winners and losers, one analysis I saw said service industries could be the big winners in this. I wonder what you think, Chris Rowland. What barriers do these companies face now doing business in the Pacific? And what could lowering them mean for, you know, people who run these companies, people who work for them?
I'm not too sure, frankly, about how service industries could be affected. I mean, certainly if there's more, you know, trade, that means more travel, that means more tourism, that means, you know, more flights, you know. So if you're going to, you know, in a truly globalized economy, people are moving around with more ease and more freedom. And so, you know, certainly I think that, you know, this goods and services as well, the service aspect is going to be bolstered. I think, you know, we have a lot of expertise in the United States, a lot of technical expertise, a lot of that could be exported. But on the other hand, we crave and demand a lot of the super just basic coders who can come over from India as well, where there's constant struggle to get visas for high-tech workers to come to the United States. So these types of service industries, high-tech service industries, could certainly benefit from having better or easier time getting visas for their workers. But honestly, I'm not sure. I'm a little bit out of my expertise on the service aspect.
Don, go ahead, and then I have another question for you, Mark. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the United States is the largest exporter of services in the world, and people forget that it includes education. That's now considered an export, construction, engineering, financial. It's a very important part of our economy, and the Trade Promotion Authority will also include sort of updated issues on the flow of data. It's sort of the digital economy, which is really important and has not been addressed in a former version or the past version of TPA. The movement of persons to provide service support is a difficulty for a lot of American companies who provide products and services, and that should be addressed in some of these trade agreements as well. So
it's so big and it's so confusing, and there's so many aspects to it that you described, Don. And then we've got 12 countries, so everybody's probably got their own idea. It just makes me wonder, maybe this is for you, Chris, you know, how they're really ever going to reach agreement on this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so a lot of this breaks down to trouble with Obama's leadership in Washington. It's extraordinary, frankly, that Democrats are so in so much rebellion over this. And I think that part of it has to do with the president's leadership style, and that he's not the greatest of political backslappers and deal makers and, you know, wooing of members of Congress. And I think a lot of what, you know, there's a good portion of what we're seeing right now is about that, that his, you know, he went to the congressional baseball game last week. You know, he went and visited with Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats in the House minority. But a lot of that felt a little bit too little too late. And I think that, you know, for this deal to go through, the president's going to have to make stronger efforts and stronger inroads into, you know, getting his party back on board. He's going to have to find some key people. You know, he's been giving some selective rides on Air Force One. He has been wooing, but, you know, sort of there's sort of a pattern where people in Congress feel somewhat neglected by President Obama, and including people in his own party. I thought it was really telling, especially when, you know, Don was sort of alluding to that there's kind of regional benefits to these trades. So you would think that California would be, you know, one of the states that would be extremely pro TPA and TPP. And yet you have Nancy Pelosi ultimately breaking with the president, sitting on her hands throughout the whole debate, and then ultimately breaking with her president at the end. And, you know, obviously Nancy Pelosi from California. That was extraordinary, I think. And so I think presidential leadership is the answer to your question.
Well, and I'll close out with an email from Alan in Durham, who says, it's very surprising to hear that organized labor has had much influence concerning the trade pact in view of the fact that labor and unions have been so emasculated in Wisconsin recently. Mark McKenzie, quick thought there on, you know, what, if anything, labor can do about this? Is there any type of deal that you guys would like to see, or are you just hoping that this will go away?
Well, first of all, you know, we're in favor of free trade around the country. Certainly, we're in favor of fair trade around the country and around the world. We don't oppose that, but we want a transparent process. We want to have an opportunity to input, and we want to make sure that the rights of workers all around the world are protected in this deal.
All right. Don, last quick thought from you?
Right. If you get TPA 2015 passed, you will have that.
The new version.
The new version. You don't have it with the old version as much as you would like. The new version will give you that.
All of you, thank you for wading through this with me. I really appreciate it. Chris Rowland, thanks for your time.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And Mark McKenzie, Don Wivel, thank you also very much for being here.
Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.